Hello, I'm your reader, Natalie Chin. And now it's time to turn to today's obituaries from the Des Moines Register. Larry Dean Hensley of Carlisle, aged 77, passed away June 22nd at the Good Samaritan Home in Indianola. Larry was born on August 21, 1942, in Springfield, Missouri, to Asa and Ruth Hensley. He served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. He was a self-employed construction worker. Larry is survived by his wife, Irene, son, Jeffrey, partner, Nicole Hensley, stepsons, Mark, partner, Teresa Dornbush, and Michael, partner, Sherry Dornbush, daughter, Kimberly Morton, six grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, sister, Bessie Miller, as well as a host of extended family and dear friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, his son, Larry Hensley Jr., his brothers Willis, Leonard, Donald, Fred, Chuck, and Jerry Hensley, and his sisters Lois Stoke, Valdinia Fawcett, and Wilma Lair. The family will greet friends Sunday, June 28th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway. Funeral services will be held on Monday, June 29th at 10 a.m. at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway. Private interment will be held at a later date at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter. Condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Deacon John McCulley, aged 85, of Ames, passed away on Thursday, June 25th at the Israel Family Hospice House. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. on Monday, June 29th at St. Cecilia Catholic Church in Ames, where there will be a vigil service held at 7 p.m. Due to concerns of COVID-19, the family will not be present during the visitation, and social distancing and use of face masks are encouraged. Mass of the Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, June 30th at St. Cecilia Catholic Church. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left for the family at www.adamssoderstrom.com. Helen Marie Hester, aged 84, of Earlham, passed away peacefully on Thursday, June 25th. Visitation will be held 5 to 8 p.m., with family present from 6 to 8 p.m. on Monday, June 29th, at Johnson Family Funeral Home in Earlham. Private family funeral service will be held on Tuesday, June 30th, at Zion Lutheran Church in Dexter. Burial will be at the Earlham City Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the Helen Hester Memorial Fund and will be directed to local organizations at a later date. Online condolences may be left at www.johnsonfamilyfuneralhome.com. U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, retired, of course, Herbert Dwayne Strasser, aged 71, of Oskaloosa, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, June 24th at Serenity Hospice House of Oskaloosa after a courageous battle against pancreatic cancer. Herbert was born on November 29, 1948, in Oskaloosa to Howard G. Swede Strasser and Darlene M. maiden name Heemstra Strasser. He was raised on the family farm north of Rose Hill and graduated from Oskaloosa High School in 1967. Herbert earned his bachelor's degree in agriculture education from Iowa State University in 1971, his master's degree in adult vocational counseling from Kansas State in 1977, and his PhD in educational leadership from Iowa State University in 1999. Herbert married Margaret I. Jackson, his high school sweetheart, on November 28, 1969, while they were both students at Iowa State University. After graduation, Herbert was commissioned as an officer in the U.S. Army. They began a career as a military family that lived in locations all over the United States and Europe and raised sons, Hale and Eric. During Herbert's military career, he was a logistics officer and helicopter maintenance test pilot, aviation company commander, and the inspector general of the 101st Airborne Division during the First Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. He also taught Army ROTC and served as the professor of military science for ISU Army ROTC. Herbert's military awards include the Bronze Star Medal, the Southwest Asia Service Medal with two Bronze Stars, Kuwait Liberation Medal, Jump Wings, Senior Army Aviator Badge, and Air Assault Badge. After serving on active duty in the U.S. Army for 23 years, Herbert retired from the military as a lieutenant colonel. In his civilian life, Herbert went on to serve as the assistant to the vice provost for ISU Extension for 4 years as he worked toward completion of his Ph.D. Herbert served on the Ames Community School Board from 1994 to 1997. He later transitioned to be Northeast Hamilton High School's curriculum director and the vocational agriculture teacher in Blairsburg, Iowa. After 12 years of teaching at Northeast Hamilton, Herbert retired again. After his formal retirement from education, Herbert briefly continued to teach ag-related courses at Ellsworth Community College. Herbert and Margaret moved back to Oskaloosa in 2015. They celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary with family and friends this past fall. In recent years, Herbert enjoyed volunteering at The Well in Pella, Serenity Hospice House, and the Nelson Pioneer Farm. He also loved restoring furniture, creating woodworking and crafting projects, gardening, landscaping, and planting trees as a master gardener, attending auctions, teaching others, and spending time with his family. Through his involvement in Boy Scouts of America, Herbert was a scoutmaster, served on the district committee in the Mid-Iowa Council BSA, and earned the Silver Beaver Award. Herbert was a member of the Knights of Pythia, Montezuma. Herbert loved both to learn and teach. He had a knack of inspiring others and possessed the knowledge and charisma to lead others toward success. Herbert is survived by his bride, Margaret, his son, Hale, partner Corey of Johnston, son, Eric, partner Melissa of Gilbert's, and Humberto, partner Doris Jones of Detroit, who was like a son to him. Grandchildren are Harrison, Eric, Sean, Jason, Hannah, Humberto, Antonio, and Gabriella. Herbert leaves behind many nieces, nephews, friends, and other relatives. He was preceded in death by his parents. As was Herb's wish, his body has been cremated. A private family memorial service will be held at a later date. Burial of the urn with military honors by members of the Oskaloosa American Legion and VFW will be in the Wymore Cemetery near Rose Hill. The Bates Funeral Chapel is in charge of the arrangements. Open visitation will begin Friday, July 10th, after 11 a.m. in the Bates Funeral Chapel, and the family will be at the funeral chapel from 5 to 7 on Friday, July 10th, in the evening to greet friends and relatives. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Nelson Pioneer Farm and Museum. Please mail all cards and memorials to P.O. Box 207, Oskaloosa, Iowa, zip code 52577. Well, that does it for obituaries today. Moving on to sports, the title story today: What Major League Baseball's Return Means for Minor League Baseball in Iowa, by Tommy Birch. Major League Baseball is finally coming back. The sport's long-awaited return is slated to finally happen next month after the Major League Baseball Players Association announced on Tuesday night that the final issues over a return-to-play squabble with owners had been resolved and that players would be reporting to training camps. The season, which is expected to kick off in July, will consist of 60 regular season games. Play had been halted ever since Major League Baseball shut down spring training camps due to the spread of the novel coronavirus. But any return had been slowed down as players and owners struggled to come to an agreement on how and when to finally return. Now that the issue is finally cleared up, there's one more pressing issue fans of the game in Iowa have. What about the minor leagues? Here's a look at what type of impact Major League Baseball's return could have on minor league baseball in Iowa. Will there be a season? Getting in a big league season will be difficult enough. A minor league season, which would require a completely reworked schedule to cut down on travel, likely won't happen. Besides, big league teams will have plenty of players available for the shortened 60-game season. Major League Baseball active rosters will carry 30 players during the regular season. Teams will also have taxi squads available with players not on the active roster working out to fill spots in case roster moves are needed. Quote, "Everybody we've talked to. We certainly anticipate there will eventually be an official announcement on the cancellation of the minor league season," said Cedar Rapids Colonels GM Scott Wilson. Could any taxi squad or pool players come to Iowa? Earlier in the month, the commissioner's office asked teams to start looking for stadium sites for taxi squads or pool players not on the active roster to use. The one requirement was to use a stadium within 100 miles of the big league club. There already have been exceptions, with the St. Louis Cardinals receiving special permission to use Hammonds Field, the home of the club's AA affiliate in Springfield, Missouri. For Iowa's minor league baseball teams, that probably won't be an option. The Chicago Cubs will likely use their affiliate in South Bend, Indiana. Wilson said he doesn't anticipate their affiliate, the Minnesota Twins, to come calling. The Burlington Bees, the Los Angeles Angels, Quad Cities River Bandits, Houston Astros, and Clinton Lumber Kings, Miami Marlins, are even farther away. To make matters more difficult, the Bees, River Bandits, and Lumber Kings were already on a preliminary list of teams that could lose their affiliations after the season. So, no affiliated baseball in Iowa this summer? Most Major League Baseball teams are looking at returning to their home parks, and if any of those don't work, Iowa's parks likely won't be in the mix due to distance alone. But Iowa Cubs President General Manager Sam Burnaby hasn't given up hope on having professional players in his building this summer. Burnaby is hoping that players on the taxi squads will need to get in more work than batting practice, infield and bullpen sessions. If they want to get some competitive games in, Principal Park could be an option, with other minor league affiliates in Omaha, Wichita, and Nashville close enough to compete. It's likely a long shot, but, quote, "I don't know how good of a possibility it is, but it's still a possibility," Burnaby said. Schools stress openness with virus, by Paul Meyerberg. For months, college football programs in the Bowl subdivision have discussed behaviors that might stem any outbreaks of the coronavirus, such as distancing and disinfection. Scattered during the spring as a result of the pandemic, coaches and players, joined at times by parents and guardians, would gather virtually to review medical guidelines and best practices, with some meetings involving university doctors and medical professionals. These discussions have continued in June as athletes resume on-campus workouts. Players at San Diego State, for example, have been given daily wellness questionnaires. Programs such as Wisconsin, Oregon, and Iowa, among many others, have outlined plans for COVID-19 testing and contact tracing with the assistance of local health officials. Quote, "We've tried not to be Big Brother in any way, but we keep talking every day about washing your hands, social distancing," said San Diego State coach Brady Hoke. While nuts and bolts health and safety remains the paramount concern, the resumption of in-person team activities has athletic departments stressing openness and accountability when it comes to sharing symptoms of the coronavirus, with some going so far as to require athletes to endorse documents detailing mandatory preventative steps or risk being barred from team activities. Quote, "It's a major encouragement," said Pittsburgh Athletic Director Heather Like. Pittsburgh's athletic department has created a program designed to make sure coaches and athletes are accountable for each other's health. Quote, "Just anything that you feel, you have to let us know," Like said. "Just kind of create an open door. I think it's just a constant reminder of the importance of we're all in this together, and we all have to be accountable. And if you're not feeling well, you're going to infect others, which obviously has a huge impact because of the number of people that you've been around," unquote. In preaching the need for this open dialogue, athletic departments are taking aim at the underlying culture of football, where injuries are often undisclosed, underreported, or ignored due to an ethos that can value toughness and sacrifice. A study conducted by Harvard and Boston University researchers in 2013 found that championship subdivision players reported having 6 suspected concussions for every diagnosed concussion, indicating that players could choose to play through an injury despite the inherent risks. In a survey conducted last summer, about 19% of college trainers said that a coach opted to play an athlete who had been deemed medically out of participation, according to the National Athletic Trainers Association. Quote, "The days of the, you know, dictator-like head football coach, I think those days are numbered," said SMU coach Sonny Dykes. "Your program has to be player-friendly. They need to be able to communicate with you and share their concerns. Whether it's concussions, whether it's COVID, whether it's social justice, you need to listen and do what's best for the young people. That's the role of the head coach, to create a culture where they're comfortable sharing those things with you and they don't worry about retaliation or something silly like that, unquote. When teams were separated during the spring, many coaches used Twitter to promote the use of masks and distancing as preventative tools. Nick Saban even filmed a public service announcement in which he scolded Alabama's mascot for not using a mask. Since the renewal of team activities, coaches have tried to model this behavior by wearing protective gear inside facilities and taking tests for COVID-19, while leaning on guidelines suggested by the Centers for Disease Control to properly space out players using weight rooms in advance of the start of practice next month. Quote, "I think the next big thing is just modeling," Dykes said. "It starts with me and carries over to our coaches and then to our players. And obviously, I take this very seriously," unquote. In some cases, athletic departments have asked players to sign pledges before resuming activities. While not considered legal documents, these waivers have raised concerns over students' rights at a time when issues such as name, image, and likeness have become part of the national debate. Some athletes, quote, "are being served letters, sometimes being written in conjunction with university lawyers, that may take away rights and limit their freedoms," said Ramogi Huma, executive director of the National College Players Association. Ohio State issued to players and parents the Buckeye Pledge, which asked that players accept that I may be exposed to COVID-19 and other infections. In addition to agreeing to coronavirus testing and preventative measures such as wearing a mask and social distancing, signing the pledge required players to monitor for symptoms and report any instances of possible exposure. According to the pledge, quote, "Failure to comply may lead to immediate removal of athletic participation privileges and the ability to use the university's training facilities, but would not threaten an athletic scholarship," unquote. As part of its plan for resuming team activities, Indiana required athletes sign an expectations and commitment pledge, quote, "that outlines the expectations to practice personal hygiene, physical distancing, non-contact with others if symptomatic, and the agreement to self-quarantine," unquote, if necessary. The first item on the pledge asks that athletes timely report any exposures to COVID-19 to the sports medicine staff. In the case of any symptoms, an athlete is directed to contact an athletic trainer and follow his or her instruction, including being tested for COVID-19 and self-quarantining while the test results are pending. Indiana announced on Tuesday that it had tested 187 athletes, coaches, and staff members without a positive result. In lieu of pledges or waivers, programs such as San Diego State are simply emphasizing and promoting that players be honest on how you feel, Hoke said. Boston College, which received players back on campus this week, issued coronavirus-related manuals to athletes and families and required a quarantine period of at least 8 days for returning athletes. Quote, "The one thing I told them, the team, I think we're being very proactive rather than reactive," said Boston College coach Jeff Hafley. "As you've seen, you can be asymptomatic and still have it. We're doing everything we can to minimize those risks. But we all have to be encouraged now, because we're here and we're back," unquote. Yet college football's return has yielded a run of unnerving COVID-19 cases. At least 30 players at LSU have been quarantined after testing positive for COVID-19 or coming into contact with someone who had. 13 players at Texas tested positive or were presumed positive for COVID-19, while 10 more were asymptomatic and placed in self-quarantine, the school announced June 18th. While the larger outbreaks draw national attention, just one positive test, if unmentioned and then untreated, has the potential to wreak havoc on a locker room and derail the upcoming season. Quote, "We want to play football," Hoke said. "These guys want to play football. They want to have a season. So we need to do everything we can do as a team and as coaches to help them navigate the challenge that has been the pandemic," unquote. Mickelson leads Travelers in first event since turning 50, by Pat Eaton Robb. Phil Mickelson figures age might be an asset. Playing his first tournament since turning 50 this month, the five-time major champion shot a 7-under-63 on Friday in the Travelers Championship to take a one-stroke lead into the weekend. Lefty said it was perhaps the wisdom that comes with his age that made him stay within himself instead of going toe-to-toe with his long-hitting playing partners, top-ranked Rory McIlroy and Bryson DeChambeau. Quote, There's some holes I can open it up and try to hit driver, but really I just want to get it in play on a lot of holes and let my wedges take over. And I've hit a lot of good wedge shots this week, said Mickelson, the 2001 and 2002 tournament winner. Two more players withdrew because of the coronavirus Friday, Denny McCarthy for a positive test and Bud Cauley, who tested negative, but decided to pull out after playing alongside McCarthy on Thursday. There have been 7 COVID-19-related withdrawals. Mickelson was at 13 under 127. First-round leader Mackenzie Hughes followed an opening 60 with a 68 to drop into a second-place tie with 23-year-old Will Gordon, who led most of the day after shooting an early 62. Since winning at Pebble Beach early last year for his 44th PGA Tour title, Mickelson has mostly struggled, with far more missed cuts than good finishes. On Friday, at tree-lined TPC River Highlands, Mickelson made a bogey on his second hole before moving up the leaderboard. He made the first of his 8 birdies from a green side bunker on number 5 and shot 30 on the back 9. While Mickelson is making his 624th PGA Tour start, Gordon is in his 8th tour event on a sponsor's exemption. He had 9 birdies and just missed a few others, including on the 4th hole where his 35-foot birdie putt came to rest on the edge of the cup. Former Drake star and 2007 Masters winner Zach Johnson shot 64 and moved up to a tie for 9th at 8 under 132, 5 shots behind Mickelson. How Major League Baseball's shortened schedule came together. You think you were the only one trying to keep your sanity awaiting Major League Baseball's to return? Meet Chris Marinac, Major League Baseball's Executive Vice President for Strategy, Technology, and Innovation. He happens to be responsible for scheduling the 2020 season, with the schedule being officially announced in the next 10 to 14 days. Quote, "Oh my God, it's been a long road," Marinac told USA Today Sports. "The struggle, the challenge was just not knowing. We all wanted to play as soon as possible, but the virus was going to dictate that. We had to wait, but wanted to be ready to go when we got the word. Now, here we are, a pretty good schedule given how much time is left." Unquote. Never has a complete Major League Baseball schedule been formulated this close to opening day, with less than a month to go. Then again, never has there ever been a season like this, operating at the will of the coronavirus pandemic. Yet Major League Baseball, with a 100-plus page health and safety operations manual, will attempt to become the first major sport to return on July 23rd, with 2 nationally televised games and the rest of the teams scheduled to start July 24th. It will be the shortest season since 1878, playing just 60 of their normal 162 games, which is 37%, with each team playing 40 games in its own division and 20 interleague games against their corresponding geographical division. So we will still have the New York Yankees and Mets playing each other 6 times. The same with the Los Angeles Dodgers and Angels, the Chicago Cubs and White Sox, the San Francisco Giants and Oakland Athletics, the Cleveland Indians and Cincinnati Reds. Marinac and Chuck Torres, Major League Baseball's Senior Director of Broadcast Operations and Administration, spent perhaps as many as 400 hours working on the thousands of permutations of the schedule, keeping in constant contact with every team. It was exasperating never knowing when the season would start or how many games would be played. You just didn't know the start date, the end date, Marinac said. The historic schedule, in some ways, was easier to formulate with no fans in the stands, at least at the outset. There was no need to worry about teams complaining about the lack of weekend home games or having too many home games when school was in session. Playing games with your own geographical within your own geographical region, eliminating cross-country flights, also lessened the burden of implementing off days or mandating day games. And with no concerts or events staged at any ballpark during this pandemic, there were no scheduling conflicts. The only event Major League Baseball needed to work around was the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee from August 17th through the 20th, making sure the Brewers were out of town for a week with the possible lack of hotel rooms. Every team will be at their home ballpark, except with the possibility of the Blue Jays, who need approval from the Canadian government to ease travel restrictions. If the Blue Jays don't receive approval, they are expected to play their home games in St. Petersburg, Florida, sharing the Tampa Bay Rays facility. This will be a schedule built for primetime TV, with the highest percentage of games during local markets' primetime in baseball history, considering the regional schedule and precious few day games. Without travel to the West Coast, no team in the AL or NL East will have to play a 10 p.m. Eastern Time game. Marinac and Torres tried to eliminate as much travel as possible. Teams that normally stop in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, or LA for a three-game series now will be staying for an entire week. There still will be two-game series, but most will last 3 and 4 games. Quote, "It was really about trying to minimize travel," Marinac said. "Taking a minimal amount of trips and staying in the same city for multiple series. We did a lot of things in the schedule trying to minimize the potential health risks. Hopefully, this will keep guys fresher." Unquote. The schedule sure came a long way from the early days of the pandemic shutdown, when Major League Baseball thought it could actually return by April 10th. Quote, "The first thing we did was, okay, we're down for a couple of weeks. How do we try to pack in games as many games as we can with the games missed?" Marinac says. "Then it became obvious we weren't playing anytime soon." Unquote. Next on the agenda was the potential Arizona bubble plan with all 30 teams. The players nixed that idea before it ever got off the ground. Quote, "That would have been a completely different structure," Marinac says. "But the players didn't want to do it. It was sort of a military-style situation. It would have been too tough to enforce the rules. Playing double headers in Arizona in 120-degree heat, is this really something we wanted to do? Then we looked at playing in Arizona and Florida. Then Arizona, Florida, and Texas. Nothing went far enough down the road, but we had nothing else to do. We were just sitting around for a month during the worst of it in late March and April with the entire world shut down. So we looked at different models and simulated as much as we could. Since there weren't fans in attendance or much criteria to worry about, it made it easier to run versions. If we went through all of the permutations of all the schedules we did, you could have stacked sheets of paper to the moon." Unquote. So now Major League Baseball can only wait and pray that COVID-19 will cooperate, enabling the 60-game regular season. Wallace Doing What Feels Right by Dan Gelston. Being an agent of change in NASCAR cuts both ways for Bubba Wallace. He is seen as a hero to some, particularly those who have longed for a black driver to shake things up in a predominantly white sport. To others, this 26-year-old Wallace represents something else entirely, and he has seen plenty of haters out on social media over his career. It has intensified in recent days. He has brushed them off, especially the ones accusing Wallace or his number 43 team of being involved in a hoax, of somehow being behind the garage door pull-down rope fashioned as a noose that was found in their garage stall at Alabama's Talladega Superspeedway last weekend. Quote, "You quickly realize," Wallace said, "they don't give a damn about you and don't give a damn about them," unquote, "and I don't give a damn about them," unquote. It has been a remarkable and exhausting 3 weeks for Wallace since he helped spark NASCAR to ban the Confederate flag at its races and venues. That is seen as a sea change for the 72-year-old stock car series with its core Southern fan base. But then came the noose and a federal investigation that ultimately determined Wallace had not been the target of a hate crime. He'd been besieged with media requests and made the rounds on morning talk shows and chatted with late-night hosts. Wallace even unified the sport when every one of the 40 teams on the grid lined up with Wallace and their series in an effort to show they do not and will not tolerate racism. The face of a movement is a tough haul for anyone, especially when he stands as the lone black driver at the top level of NASCAR. Quote, "It's just what I feel in my heart, what feels right," Wallace said Friday. "I'm finally voicing my opinion on the tough subjects that a lot of people are afraid to touch on. I'm not afraid to speak my mind. I've done it and gotten in trouble and learned from it. People that know me, I'm 100% raw and real," unquote. It's part of his appeal and why a small number of black fans rushed the fence and cheered for Wallace after he finished 14th at Talladega. "He wants more black fans in NASCAR," he said. His social media following has exploded, and scores of famous fans like LeBron James have offered support and said he is ready to lead the charge. He would also like some of his newfound fame to lead to more sponsorship to fund the number 43 Chevrolet for Richard Petty Motorsports. He's not going to change his approach for them. Quote, "Ever since I've been speaking out, I haven't been thinking about my sponsors," Wallace said. "I've been thinking about me being a human being and standing up for what's right. I would hope that sponsors would see that and back me up on that," unquote. But he's tired. His free time has been chewed up, and life in the spotlight as a national newsmaker has him wore the hell out, and there are two more races this weekend for a team that has been running well. Quote, "It's not like I wanted to be in this position, or asked to be in this position," Wallace said. "It just kind of happened," unquote. He is grateful NASCAR released the photo of the rope. NASCAR President Steve Phelps stated the noose was real, though it remains unknown who tied it. Phelps said NASCAR determined the noose was not in place when the October 2019 race weekend began, but was created at some point during that weekend. Quote, "We can't say it was directed toward me, which is good," Wallace said. "But somebody still knows how to tie a noose. Whether they did it as a bad joke or not, who knows? It was good for the public to see. It still won't change some people's minds of me being a hoax, but it is what it is," unquote. He has received support from NASCAR friends and foes, like driver Eric Almirola, who started a text, "We're not friends, and we don't act like we are," but was ready to stand next to Wallace as a brother. NASCAR is at Pocono Raceway for Cup Series races on Saturday and Sunday, just one more piece of a grueling schedule where all eyes are on Wallace. In brief, Indianapolis 500 will run with 50% fan capacity at Speedway. The Indianapolis 500 will run in August with 50% fan capacity, a total that could hit six figures at the famed Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The Indy 500 was bumped from its traditional May date because of the coronavirus pandemic. The 104th Indy 500 will run August 23rd at half the total of what is traditionally one of the biggest sporting events of the year. Quote, the quote-unquote greatest spectacle in racing can pack about 250,000 fans in the spacious speedway, leaving plenty of room if the total is limited to half that total. Quote, "We're committed to running the Indy 500 on Sunday, August 23rd, and will welcome fans to the world's greatest racing venue," IMS President J. Douglas Bowles said. "We will be limiting attendance to approximately 50%, and we are also finalizing a number of additional carefully considered health and safety measures," unquote. The IMS teams is working with public health officials to complete a comprehensive plan of health measures. Indianapolis Motor Speedway will still host an IndyCar NASCAR doubleheader on the July 4th weekend without fans. Dolphins owner pledges $13 million to anti-racism initiative. Miami Dolphins owner Stephen Ross pledged an additional $13 million over 4 years to his anti-racism Rise initiative, the organization said Friday. The Ross Initiative in Sports for Equality was established 5 years ago to promote unity and combat systemic racism. Rise says it has helped 12,000 students, athletes, coaches, and staff at all levels to help champion social justice and improve race relations. Ross has committed $30 million to Rise. NBA players sign off on final terms for restarted season. The NBA and the National Basketball Players Association have finalized terms of the deal that will allow the league to restart the season at the Disney World campus near Orlando, Florida, next month. The league and the union made the announcement Friday. Many of the details were already known, such as how stringent health and safety protocols would be in place for the 22 teams that will be participating, that no fans will be present, and that games will be held in three different arenas at the ESPN Wide World of Sports complex. With all necessary details completed and agreed upon, the NBA said it would release the schedule for the 88 seeding games, 8 games for each of the 22 clubs starting on July 30th, later Friday, as well as the national broadcast schedule for that portion of the series. Moving on to the Iowa Life section, Bondurant Bike Trail mural work of high schoolers. And there are several photos, one of some students working on plans for the public mural at the Bondurant Farrar High School, as well as them painting a colorful rainbow mural designing and painting its 100-foot-long mural to be displayed on the local bike trail. This article is by Robin Upsall. If you've noticed a new mural on Bondurant's Chicacua Valley Trail, thank art students at Bondurant Farrar High School and expect more installations over the next few years. Local high schoolers worked with Bondurant native Chris Vance throughout 2019 to create a 100-foot-long mural on the side of the bus barn, which stores the school district's buses, facing the bike trail. Christian Vandahar, a 33-year-old art teacher at Bondurant Farrar, said the project gave students an opportunity to see how art projects work in real life. Students submitted a design, helped write proposals, and worked together to create the public art. Quote, "I was trained as a studio artist. A lot of my friends are actual designers," he said. "We wanted to give an outlet to these kids to not just give back to their community, but learn how the processes of design and construction, to see how these projects work if they ever wanted to do something like this professionally," unquote. Rising sophomores and juniors in the 2018-19 school year spent 3 school days painting 4x10-foot metal panels. Chris Vance, a professional artist on site, taught the students how to spray paint, which they used for the 27 total panels, Vandahar said. Vance is behind multiple murals throughout the Des Moines area, including pieces in Des Moines' East Village and Drake neighborhoods. The Bondurant Community Foundation worked with Vance and the school district to bring the mural to fruition, said Jeff Cook, who runs the Community Foundation. Cook worked with students to get funding for the project with Des Moines area art and community nonprofits, as well as donations from local businesses and individuals. Along with providing resources for the art, donations went towards lighting and art at night, along with security cameras, a bench, and a plaque, and landscaping. Parks and trails are important, not only for the individuals or residents, but for businesses as well, Cook said. We just feel that that's the whole outdoors aspect of it, and bringing culture to the community is important, and we want to make sure that continues, unquote. The Community Foundation plans to continue to bring art outdoors and around Bondurant with similar projects, he said. There are 2 or 3 places on the bike trail the foundation hopes to add in permanent art installations, in addition to places where the community can show off rotating installations. Vandahar hopes to keep local art students involved. In previous years, Bondurant Farrar students designed a swing set and a logo for the city and would love to work on future art installations around the town. Quote, "Not every community has programs outlets like this for our artistic students to get involved," he said. "We're very lucky and grateful to have opportunities like this for such talented students, and we hope to have more chances like this in the future," unquote. Luminaries Lost. A Look at Some of the Artists Lost to the Virus by Andrew Dalton. A trumpeter who came up in the shadow of Miles Davis, then stepped out of it. An architect whose soaring stadiums and concert halls are sitting silent in his native Italy. A rocker whose song gave flight to Joan Jett. In the 4th installment in a series, the Associated Press takes a look at prominent figures in arts, entertainment, and culture who have died after contracting the coronavirus in a global pandemic. Wallace Roney, musician, United States. Wallace Roney lived in the shadow of his hero and mentor Miles Davis, often by choice. But he also forged a storied 4-decade career for himself as a jazz trumpeter and bandleader. The Philadelphia-born son of a U.S. Marshal, Roney was a child prodigy on trumpet who was making waves in New York's serious jazz circles as a teenager. He would soon be invited to the genre's elite heights when he was asked to join Art Blakey in the Jazz Messengers. He began churning out a steady stream of records with his own band and a sharp, strong, disciplined form of post-bop jazz starting in the late 1980s. At the 1991 Montreux Jazz Festival, where Quincy Jones had arranged for Davis to revisit his classic orchestral albums, Roney stood in for him at rehearsals. Davis insisted that Roney play alongside him, taking many of the most technically demanding solos. Quote, "Wallace Roney's journey has ended in this lifetime, but his impact lives on," jazz pianist Herbie Hancock said in a statement. He carved out his own voice on the trumpet, even with the initial strong influence from Miles Davis, unquote. Roney died March 31st at a hospital in Paterson, New Jersey, his publicist Lydia Liebman said. He was 59. Vittorio Gregotti, architect, Italy. Vittorio Gregotti built huge, sweeping structures to house tens of thousands of people that all stood empty at the time of his death amid the coronavirus pandemic. The Italian modernist architect counted the Arcimbaldi Opera Theater in Milan, the Belém Cultural Center in Lisbon, and Barcelona's Olympic Stadium among his creations, which managed to be contemporary while paying tribute to the classical past. He also planned and designed university campuses, including the University of Calabria in Italy, and oversaw the creation of an entire suburban town outside Shanghai that was based on Italian architecture. Gregotti was a great Italian architect and urban planner who has given prestige to our country and the world, Dario Franceschini, Italy's Minister of Cultural Heritage, said in a statement. Gregotti died in a hospital in Milan on March 14th, Michele Reginaldi, a former partner at his firm, told the New York Times. He was 90. Oscar Chavez, singer in Mexico. Among the best-known protest singers in the nation's history, his songs included La Casita, or The Little House, which described the lavish mansion of an imaginary politician. His music was inspired by the Nueva Trova movement that began after the Cuban Revolution and spread across Latin America in the 1960s, merging traditional folk tunes with modern political and progressive songs. Chavez had sung widely beloved ballads for over 50 years and played in public as recently as 2019. Quote, "Thank you, Oscar Chavez. Your life was a journey worthy of you," Mexico's culture secretary Alejandro Frausto wrote on her Twitter account. Interior Secretary Olga Sanchez tweeted, "I have learned to my deep regret that a voice of the struggle has been silenced," unquote. Chavez died April 30th in a hospital in Mexico City, Frausto said. He was 85. Julie Bennett, voice actress, United States. Julie Bennett was a voiceover actress best known for playing Cindy Bear, the cartoon girlfriend of Yogi Bear, for nearly 30 years from the early 1960s through the late 1980s. She voiced dozens more characters for animated shows, including Fractured Fairy Tales, Mr. Magoo, The Banana Splits, and Spider-Man, the animated series. Outside of animation, she was a regular as a sketch comedian on The Tonight Show and The Sid Caesar Show, and acted on Dragnet and Leave It to Beaver. In the 1990s, Bennett reinvented herself, taking on the name Marianne Daniels and working as a personal manager for established actors and for talent she discovered at colleges and in small theaters. Bennett died March 31st at a Los Angeles hospital, her agent and friend Mark Scroggs said. She was 88. William Wolfe, film and theater critic, United States. William Wolfe was a longtime film and theater critic whose work appeared in Q Magazine, New York Magazine, and Gannett newspapers. He was also a former chair of the New York Film Critics Circle, which gives out important year-end film awards, and a former president of Drama Desk, which does the same for theater. Wolfe was a New Jersey native who worked for the Associated Press in West Virginia and as a freelance foreign correspondent early in his career. He died March 28th at a New York hospital, his wife Lillian Kramer Wolfe said. He was 94. Alan Merrill, musician and songwriter, United States. Alan Merrill loved rock and roll. He used it to become a major pop star in Japan in the early 1970s, an unheard-of feat at the time. And he rode it to fame in England, where his band, The Arrows, had several hits and a TV show. In the United States, the Bronx-born Merrill's name, face, and guitar were little known, but a song he wrote is in the pantheons of both classic rock and 80s hits. Joan Jett and the Blackhearts' cover of The Arrows' song, I Love Rock and Roll, written by Merrill, went to number one on the Billboard charts and was the number three song of 1982. Quote, "I can still remember watching The Arrows on TV in London and being blown away by the song that screamed hit to me," Jett said on Twitter. Merrill died on March 29th in New York, his daughter Laura Merrill said. He was 69. Moving on to some more news. Coronavirus updates. U.S. reports another day of record high cases. Americans likely won't be allowed to travel to the European Union anytime soon. By Grace Hawk and Joel Shannon from USA Today. Coronavirus cases shot up in states across the country this week as the U.S. continues to see record single-day increases in new confirmed cases since the beginning of the pandemic. On Friday, the U.S. reported 45,255 new cases, according to data maintained by Johns Hopkins University. It's the second day of record-high increases. Thursday saw 39,972 new cases. Texas and Florida continued to pump the brakes on reopening plans, and California Governor Gavin Newsom urged one county to reinstate its stay-at-home order amid a surge in cases there. Amid the resurgence, the White House Coronavirus Task Force held its first public briefing in nearly 2 months Friday, urging young adults to follow public health guidance for containing the COVID-19 outbreak. The increase in cases isn't due to an increase in testing, health officials say. Here are the most significant developments of the day. Beaches in Miami-Dade County will be closed over 4th of July weekend, County Mayor Carlos Jimenez announced Friday. A journalist who attended President Donald Trump's rally in Tulsa last week said Friday he has tested positive for COVID-19. Stocks capped a volatile week with steep losses Friday as coronavirus cases in the U.S. surged. Texas Governor Greg Abbott on Friday announced another round of restrictions, including closing bars and limiting restaurant occupancy. And in Florida, bars on Friday were prohibited from allowing alcohol consumption. The federal government will continue to fund community testing sites across Texas, Abbott announced Friday. The sites were due to stop receiving funding at the end of the month. In their first public briefing since April 27th, White House Coronavirus Task Force officials pleaded with adults under 40 to act responsibly to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Vice President Mike Pence did not wear a mask during the news conference. Today's stats, the world is nearing a 500,000 deaths, with more than 125,000 of them in the United States. As of Saturday, there have been more than 9.8 million confirmed cases worldwide and almost 2.5 million in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University. What we're reading. Dr. Anthony Fauci recently told the Washington Post that officials are talking about implementing a new strategy that tests groups of people together. It's known as pool testing, and we explain here what it is. Excuse me, that was a link to another article which I cannot access, but I've got some more information. Miami closes beaches for 4th of July. Beaches in Miami-Dade County will be closed July 3rd through July 7th, County Mayor Carlos Jimenez announced Friday amid a surge of coronavirus cases in Florida. Jimenez said his emergency order also bans any gatherings, including parades, of more than 50 people throughout the county for whatever reason. In those situations, masks and social distancing are required, and 5 groups of no more than 10 people will be allowed, Jimenez said. The closure may be extended if conditions do not improve, and people do not follow new normal rules requiring masks to be worn always inside commercial establishments and outdoors when social distancing of at least 6 feet is not possible, Jimenez said. I have been seeing too many businesses and people ignoring these life-saving rules, unquote. Florida reported a record 8,942 cases on Friday, a 62% increase over the previous daily record of 5,508 reported Wednesday. From a judge, the U.S. must free migrant children from detention amid pandemic. A federal judge on Friday ordered the release of children held with their parents in U.S. immigration jails and denounced the Trump administration's prolonged detention of families during the coronavirus pandemic. U.S. District Judge Dolly G's order applies to children held for more than 20 days at 3 family detention centers in Texas and Pennsylvania operated by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Some have been detained since last year. Citing the recent spread of the virus in 2 of the 3 facilities, G set a deadline of July 17th for children to either be released with their parents or sent to family sponsors. The family detention centers are on fire, and there is no more time for half measures, she wrote. U.S. citizens likely won't be allowed to travel to the European Union anytime soon. European Union envoys are close to finalizing a list of countries whose citizens will be allowed to enter Europe again, possibly from late next week, European Union diplomats confirmed Saturday. Americans are almost certain to be excluded in the short term due to the number of U.S. coronavirus cases. The envoys were expected to have narrowed down later Saturday the exact criteria for countries to make the list, which include the way the spread of the coronavirus is being managed. Another key condition is whether the country has a ban on citizens from European nations. The number of cases in the United States has surged over the past week, with an all-time high of 45,300 confirmed new daily infections just reached. President Donald Trump also suspended the entry of all people from Europe's ID check-free travel zone in a decree in March. The EU diplomats confirmed that an official agreement on the criteria, likely to include a limit on the infection rate per 100,000 citizens, is expected late on Monday or early Tuesday. The diplomats spoke on condition of anonymity because the procedure is ongoing and politically very sensitive. More underlying medical conditions that increase risk of severe coronavirus. The CDC on Thursday updated and expanded the list of who is at increased risk for getting severely ill from COVID-19. The CDC now warns that among adults, risk increases steadily as you age, and it's not just those over the age of 65 who are at increased risk for severe illness, the CDC said. The agency updated the list of underlying medical conditions that increase risk of severe illness, increasing the number of people who fall into higher risk groups. The more underlying medical conditions people have, the higher their risk, CDC said. The conditions include chronic kidney disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, obesity, weakened immune system from solid organ transplant, serious heart conditions such as heart failure, coronary artery disease, or cardiomyopathies, sickle cell disease, type 2 diabetes. Florida babies are getting COVID-19 at high rates this month. Infants and young children are rapidly catching the coronavirus and increasingly ending up in the hospital this month, according to an analysis of data from the Florida Department of Health. Since June 1st, more than 1,100 children ages 4 and younger have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, accounting for 70% of the total cases in the age group. While more testing has been opened up to younger people this month, emergency department visits and hospitalizations have dramatically increased in June. More than half the total reported emergency department visits for the state's youngest have come this month, and 40% of the hospitalizations of children up to 4 have come since June 1st. Florida hospitals are reporting about 34% capacity of their 620 pediatric intensive care unit beds, according to Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration data Friday afternoon. Adult capacity was at 21% of just over 6,000 beds. Costco no longer selling sheet cakes. Costco has started to bring back its legendary free samples to some clubs, but they'll be prepackaged items and kept behind plexiglass shields, according to Bloomberg, which reported Thursday that sampling has returned to as many as 30 of Costco's 548 U.S. locations. While samples are coming back, Costco has stopped selling its half-sheet cakes at all U.S. clubs, the company confirmed to USA Today, noting, quote, "As of right now, we have no immediate plans to bring it back," unquote. Costco said the sheet cakes aren't available for special order and explained the decision in responding to comments on the Facebook post. Quote, "To help limit personal contact and create more space for social distancing, Costco has reduced service in some departments," Costco wrote. Reporter at Trump's Tulsa rally tests positive for COVID-19. A journalist who attended President Donald Trump's rally in Tulsa last week said Friday he has tested positive for COVID-19. Quote, "I'm pretty surprised," Oklahoma Watch reporter Paul Moneys wrote on Twitter. "I have zero symptoms so far, and I feel fine. In fact, I ran 5 miles this morning," unquote. Moneys said he was inside the rally for about 6 hours on Saturday at the BOK Center and that he wore a mask and mostly practiced social distancing, except for when he went to the concourse to get a snack. He said he was never close to the president. an epidemiologist at the Oklahoma City County Health Department, who notified Moniz of his positive result, said it's difficult to determine if he contracted the coronavirus at the rally. Wrapping up, it's time for Dear Abby. Spouse's moodiness may signal deeper problems. Dear Abby, I have a question about my daughter's new husband, Brad. I haven't interfered with their marriage and don't want to, but he seems very moody and barely speaks to me. Just when I think I've found a common topic, on the next visit 4 or 5 weeks later, he doesn't say a word. During my last visit, he got very upset with my daughter because a piece of chicken fell out of his wrap while she was tasting it. She apologized twice, but her eyes were watering when I walked into the room. I wanted so badly to just hug her and ask Brad, "What's wrong with you?" I have heard his tone before. Should I do anything? From Questioning in the South. Dear Questioning, if Brad has behaved this way before when you were visiting, is it possible that your visit was inconvenient for him? Could they be having marital problems? I don't think it would qualify as interference to ask your daughter how often her husband gets upset over things as trivial as a piece of chicken spilling out of his wrap. Exploding over something so insignificant could be an indication that there is a larger problem that hasn't been dealt with. It also would not be interfering to let your daughter know that if this happens often, it isn't normal, and that you are, and always will be, there for her if she feels she needs it. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Saturday, June 27th. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.com. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council City Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with the schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Natalie Chin. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading.